Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, Amazon launched another 500 products, and I'm only exaggerating a little bit. Amazon hosted an event virtually for the first time out of its spheres in Seattle, and we have a bunch of Amazon-branded products, a bunch of Ring-branded products, a bunch of crazy drones and all these other interesting things, and a new Eero router, which I'm really excited about. And there's also a new streaming gaming service that is going to take on not just Stadia, but Xbox Game Pass, and we will talk a lot about that. Plus, Google's launch night in event is next Wednesday, but we already know everything that there is to know. We will talk about the latest leaks coming out of Google land, including this green Pixel 5 that I'm lusting after. And then at the end of the show, we will talk about the Oculus Quest 2 and the state of VR right now. So joining me, welcome back to the show, Nicholas Sutrick. How are you? It's been a while since you were on. We talked to you about VR and AR last time.
Yes, I'm glad to be here again.
Are you?
Yes, I think. Maybe.
Yeah, you don't know. You don't know what kind of grilling you're in for. I don't know Absolutely. Anything about VR, so I love bringing you on and just being completely ignorant about it and asking you all the questions that I want answered for myself. And joining us for the first time is our sort of smart home editor. I say sort of because you do so many different things. Jeremy Johnson, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no worries. So we'll get right into it because, Jeremy, you were sort of running the show yesterday, writing about all of these Amazon products that got announced. And so we'll just start from the top, right? Amazon comes out of the gate with its, as every big tech company does, it tries to paint itself in the best light possible. And the first thing Amazon does is says that it wants to become carbon neutral by, I forget exactly when, it wants to sort of start building its products with recycled material. It really just wants to take stock of its environmental impact and lower it for the millions of people that it interacts with every day. What does that say? First, walk us through what those announcements were, and also what does it say about Amazon today as it kind of as it's perceived by all these people that use its services every day.
Sure. Well, before I start, I wanted to issue a word of caution to our listeners that you may want to mute your Amazon Echo devices during this conversation because I think we're going to be saying the A word quite a bit.
That's true. Yeah. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially once you get to a certain topic.
Exactly.
If you say the words.
Exactly. I thought it was really interesting that they started off with the environmental pledge or the climate pledge, rather, instead of just jumping into products or even talking about how the pandemic has been affecting people. They said that they were an initial signatory to this climate pledge that they mentioned and that they've been working to ensure that the company across the board will be carbon neutral, fully carbon neutral by, I think they said 2040 was the year that they gave. They did say that they're going to beat those predictions that they believe. They talked about all kinds of things from a new sustainable product program that's going to be across all verticals on Amazon.com. They mentioned that earlier this week, and that's going to include products like consumer products and electronics. And they had said that these new Echo and Fire TV devices that we're going to talk about are among the first Amazon devices that will be officially part of that sustainable product program.
Right. Post 100% post-consumer recyclable fabric and 100% recyclable die-cast aluminum for those products, respectively.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the fabric thing was something that Google had mentioned last year with the Nest Mini is kind of their initial entree into sustainable materials. And Apple has talked for a couple years now about how it's doing recycled aluminum for, you know, the MacBook cases and the iPhones and things like that. So it's great to see that Amazon's actually putting effort into sustainable materials, which we haven't really seen before. But immediately after they said that, they talked about how they had done some research, and I forget the exact percentage, maybe you remember, Daniel, but it was something like 60% or more of the carbon footprint of Amazon devices were not actually the build of materials, but it was when the devices were in use, like the draw on the grid.
Right.
So another thing that they talked about, which I think is even more important, honestly, than whatever the Echo speakers and Fire Sticks and whatnot are made out of, is a program to kind of offset not only their corporate usage and their factories and their servers and all that kind of stuff, but to offset consumer draw on the grid from these Echo devices and speakers. And they talked a couple different ways about doing that. They talked about wind energy and some other sustainable energy products that they had going. But they said that these new devices were going to be engineered to where they would be using substantially less draw on the grid than previous versions. But then they also talked about pushing out an over-the-air update for current Echo devices. I can't remember if they mentioned other ones specifically, that would optimize the firmware so that they would be drawing less energy from the grid when they're in use and also when they're just kind of sitting there plugged in.
I mean, this is not surprising, right? As you said, Google and Apple have been pledging similar things over the last few years, and this is Amazon kind of catching up to the status quo. The difference here is that Amazon is a massive logistics company. It has a physical presence in both manufacturing and supply chains and distribution that neither Google nor, well, Apple does, obviously, but Apple is also, it outsources the manufacturing of its products. So it's mainly involved in the distribution, but it does not own the factories the way that Amazon owns the factories. What is really interesting is that Google, or Amazon rather, is rolling out an energy dashboard in its Alexa app that will allow users to see exactly how much energy their devices are using. And what's fascinating to me is, like, I look at my monthly expenditure in terms of energy. Ontario, Canada, where I live, has some of the highest cost of electricity in the world. So it is not surprising that, you know, when I get my bill, I'm always alarmed. But over the last few years, I've seen this sort of energy use creep up, even though we are way more cognizant of things like turning off lights and making sure that we are doing the explicit things to lower energy use, but the implicit things, or the less subtle, the more subtle things, like unplugging wireless chargers, or just like things that draw a small amount of energy when you don't have them in use, those add up to a fairly large amount over the course of a month or a year. And Amazon, by showing you exactly how much energy your all of the devices attached to your Amazon account are using, that could be fairly helpful. Or it could be as useful as something like a Fitbit, which tells you you only took 2,000 steps yesterday, you're a lazy bum, and then you don't do anything about it because it's easier to just ignore it. So that's the other side.
I'm glad you mentioned that portion of the conversation, because one of the things that I forgot to mention is, and we saw this come up time and time again throughout their presentation, was how they're making Alexa smarter and smarter and smarter. And one of the features that they highlighted was specific to this environmental commitment in the dashboard that you mentioned within the Alexa app. So the idea is that Alexa, through the Alexa app, is going to be able to see your energy usage per your Echo and your Amazon devices, and theoretically proactively suggest actions that you can take to better manage your energy usage. So that's one level of it. And then they mentioned that you could use Alexa routines, which are really powerful, but I don't think enough people know about or even use, to do things like very common things, but I think it will really help out in people's energy usage. Like, you know, if a light has been on for so many hours, automatically turn it off, or, you know, that kind of thing to help you manage your smart home better.
Right. So all of this was a sort of preamble to a lot of the intelligence improvements that are coming to Alexa, from smarter from a more natural voice, using neural engines to process the signal and to make Alexa sound more natural when she's communicating, to this new AZ-1 neural edge processor, which is, I think, the first time that Amazon has talked about its own silicon in a major way. This is going into the new Echo and Echo Show 10, Echo speakers and Echo Show 10, and it's promising speech recognition or processing twice as fast as the previous generation with 85% lower memory usage. So what we're going to see is faster processing of your commands, of your queries. It's going to make Alexa more conversant, or there's a new feature where you can basically say, Alexa, join the conversation, and you could be talking to somebody else in the room and have Alexa sort of listening in those moments and pipe in whenever she hears something that's useful. I'm very skeptical of this because it's never quite as smooth as it is in the demos, but this demo showed off two people in a kitchen looking up, I think it was like pizza restaurants in the area, and then listing off various things on the menu, and then, you know, Alexa's listing off, I want, you know, deluxe, or I want Hawaiian, or whatever, and then the person goes, I want that one, and then Alexa says, okay, I'll order it for you. That seemed way too good to be true, but what this does tell me is that Amazon is finally, at least on the surface, trying to catch up to Google when it comes to actual natural language processing, which it has always been lagging behind, and where Google Assistant just has a massive advantage right now. So that's really interesting.
To be fair, everyone else has too, though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny, Daniel, that you... I'm sorry, Nick.
No, I was going to say, Google has just been so ahead in that area.
Oh, yeah.
From everybody, really. I mean, it's crazy the gulf that they had for such a long time.
Right. And is it the case of Amazon and Apple are improving faster than Google is improving at this point? Or is it merely that we are sort of reaching the edge of this generation of natural language processing, and that there's only so much more that can be achieved until we get some sort of a next level advancement in machine learning? I it's unclear. We'll see what happens with Google Assistant next year. But I haven't seen, you know, that Google Assistant demo that Google showed off at I/O 2019 has not really manifested in the way that they showed off on stage either, right? The instant responses, the dynamic interactions between you and the assistant. I would say Assistant is very good at most things, at handling most queries, but it is nowhere near as good as what Google showed off on stage, even today.
I was going to say, it's funny that you mentioned the pizza demo seeming too good to be true, because when I was watching that, I almost kind of cringed a little and thought it was very, very mechanical, very if this, then that kind of logic. It's still impressive, but no, I wasn't as wowed by that. And then in terms of, you know, are Alexa and Siri, or Apple and Amazon rather, gaining more ground than Google, I think that perhaps because they were further behind, it seems like every little advancement they have is a bigger leap that they have to catch up. But yeah, one of the demos that they were showing off, that improved Alexa learning, I think they called it, that was kind of interesting, was when the guy was essentially training his Echo, training Alexa to know what he means when he says XYZ. So he would say, you know, Alexa, set a alarm for 6:30 a.m. or something. And she basically said, okay, when you say set an alarm, do you mean for this time or something? And he said, yeah. And so she would remember that. Right. And they were touting how that was like such an advancement to be conversationally remembering preferences per user and that kind of thing.
Which is impressive. I mean, Google can't do that. If you say, you know, set my alarm to 6:30, and then that, you know, if that's going to be your normal alarm, so that you just the next morning, the next day, you say set my alarm, and the, you know, Echo knows that you're saying for 6:30, that makes sense. It's just it's a preference thing. I think we should move on, because there's a ton of other things that Amazon announced. I want to get through them all. So
yeah,
you know, there's new voice profiles for kids, which we'll talk about in a sec. Amazon changed its the name of Free Time Unlimited, which is sort of its like kids bundle of apps and services, to Amazon Kids and Kids Plus recently. That was in a precursor to what Amazon announced here, which were new Amazon Echo Dot Kids editions. There's new privacy features that I think a lot of people were expecting Amazon to double down on. The one that really stuck out was Alexa, delete everything I said, which is this really kind of one-stop shop for, like, Amazon does not want people to think that it is listening to you at all times, nor does it want you to think that it's storing things that it doesn't, that you don't want it to store. So let's just let everybody say, delete everything I ever said, and then just wipe the slate clean. I see people using this fairly often to just be like, I don't want anything lingering. I just want to start fresh. The downside to that, though, is that then you will have to retrain Alexa every time you do this. So I think there needs to be a happy medium. And I know Amazon already allows you to delete what I just said or delete what I said today. Those are existing features that Alexa offers. So this is just going the next step. And I think this is on the road to sort of redemption for the company that has been so accused of invading people's privacy. But as we'll talk about in the Ring section, it doesn't always jibe with what that brand has, the perception of that brand. So there's also a new Alexa Care Hub for elders, people who kind of don't have a person on site that they can call easily. This allows people in vulnerable situations to just ask Alexa for something. Like, it's basically hands-free emergency calling. If the microphone notices a lot of activity, it can alert an emergency contact. And then there's this new Alexa Guard Plus, which is a paid version of Alexa Guard, which was launched a couple of years ago. It's basically it's sort of like using your speaker as a security device, listening for glass breaking, for shouting, things that may alert, that you may want to alert the authorities about. And it just takes it to that next level. So $5 a month, $50 a year. I'm not sure if that's what people want, to be honest, but it is interesting nonetheless. All right, let's move on to the actual Echo hardware. So these were big announcements, big deals, in the sense that the new Echo and Echo Dot look completely different, Jeremy, than they ever have. They're now spherical. They look a little bit more, I would say, I don't want to say natural, but at least they look a little bit more welcoming than the obelisk that the Echo originally launched as. So what's your impression of these new devices, especially since they offer not just better design, but improved sound and like smart home stuff as well?
I was surprised that I actually like the new spherical ball style look to them. I know the cylinders that Alexa had originated in are kind of iconic, but now every smart speaker or Bluetooth speaker kind of looks that way and has that form factor. It's kind of the same situation how all up until the foldable era, all smartphones kind of looked like flat glass slabs. So I think it's a nice change. And I like that the regular size Echo, Echo fourth gen, and the dots and the dot with clock and the kids ones all have the same look and consistent design. They kind of remind me of that. They kind of remind me of that Nexus Q device that Google teased years back that never kind of came to fruition.
Oh, it came to fruition. It died as soon as it came out. I don't know, Nick. That's did you true. Ever have one of those?
Nope.
I
never
did.
Even got to see it in person either.
Yeah,
it was spectacular. It was spectacular.
I wanted one. I think for the same reason that maybe you like this design. It looks super cool.
Right.
Especially with the glowy light on the bottom.
Yeah, it looks like a mini Death Star or something like that is kind of what I thought, especially if you get the charcoal one.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the Disney tie-in so they can make it the Epcot ball. I imagine Era will probably have like 20 of them.
Yes, indeed.
Or you get some kind of D-brand skin to go over it or something like that.
And sorry if I butchered her name.
It's okay, I butcher yours all the time, so.
Yeah, well.
Daniel butchers all of our names, so
it's true, cool. Jeremy.
Nice. Yeah, as far as the sound goes, I mean, being a sphere, you have the opportunity to have more of a 360-degree sound, kind of like you get with like a Sonos One or an Echo Studio. And they even said that the big Echo, the regular Echo, will have that same ability that those speakers have to, you know, acoustically scan the room and fill the space evenly and more appropriately with sound. So I think that's pretty great. And also the larger Echo and the new Echo Show 10, which I know we'll probably talk about too, will both have Zigbee Hugs built in as well.
Yes, and that was really cool.
Yeah, that's a big thing. At first, I was kind of like, why are they doing that? Because last year at the 2019 event, they made such a big deal out of their Certified for Humans program, I think it was called, which was basically trying to create a certification, or not even a standard really, but products that would be smart home products that would be easy for people to set up that wouldn't require a hub, etc. And that meant that like the original Echo Plus and the Echo Plus second generation that had Zigbee hubs were kind of unnecessary, and now they're going back and reintroducing those into the larger Halo products, if you will, for the Echoes. But then I remembered they had just started talking again this past week about the Amazon Sidewalk initiative, which is another thing I'm sure we need to talk about at some point. And so those devices have the Zigbee hubs more than likely to work with Amazon Sidewalk.
It's interesting, right? Because Zigbee has sort of become the de facto smart home standard for at least for setup and communication. I believe Sidewalk uses Bluetooth Low Energy, but we could get in there and talk a little bit more about it. What I'm finding interesting about the Echo is that this, by adding the Zigbee hub and by focusing it more as the smart home center of your, you know, Alexa world or whatever you want to call it, they're sort of negating the need for an Echo Plus, which they've had for a few years now. And it does seem like that product line has sort of outlived its usefulness in terms of the hierarchy, right? You have one really good sounding Echo that does everything else in terms of smart home compatibility. And then you have your Echo Dot, which is now about the same size as the Echo, but it just doesn't have the same audio chops and may not have those additional features like the smart home integration. So I wonder, you know, that simplification of the line also makes more sense to me.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too in terms of, you know, Rene Ritchie used to always talk about how Apple's not afraid to cannibalize its own products. And it kind of seems a little bit like that's what Amazon's been doing with the Echo line. So, you know, the Echo begat the Echo Plus, which kind of begat the Echo Studio, and now it's kind of gone back to the Echo again, where that product has inherited traits from those other devices that were more expensive and maybe more premium, like the Zigbee Hub, like the surround sound of the Studio, and now it's kind of in a more accessible, cheaper, universal product.
Yeah, and we'll wait and see until it comes out in late October whether it does sound significantly better than the third gen, or even if it sounds better than the Echo Plus. But just comparing the two, the Echo Dot versus the Echo fourth gen, the Echo Dot does seem I think it's at least comparing it on the website, it says it has the same 41 millimeter 1.6 inch speaker as the third gen, but the Echo fourth gen has a better speaker setup. It has a dual front firing tweeters and a dedicated woofer over the third gen Echo. So I'm hoping it'll sound better than especially if once we talk about the Nest Audio, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. It seems like it's important that Amazon doubled down on what works for the Echo. Before we move on to talk about the other devices, I do want to just mention these adorable kids edition Echo Dots.
They are really cute.
Nick, you have a young kid. Like, do these kids edition play into your lives at all? Like, is this something that you seek out?
I mean, we don't have one in his room. And I think that's something I've actively done on purpose. I could see us doing it when he gets a little bit older, but I feel like six is still a little too young to give him his own speaker. But I guess with that being said, the point of these, aside from them looking cute, is that they have built in parental control features, right? Versus a regular speaker that you can just kind of ask anything and get all sorts of bad responses if you're not careful.
Yeah, I mean, there are some, I think there are built-in parental controls to all of these speakers, but these ones come with them on by default.
Right, that's what I mean, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, they're cute, they're also kind of cheap, and they do the job that a lot of parents want, is just to, you know, if you need something to entertain your kid for a little bit, or they showed off the new story reading feature in these Echo Dot Kids editions.
Right.
I think these are going to be insanely popular. Obviously, they always are. There are like these new fabric panda and tiger skins, essentially, which are kind of funny. I don't know. I'm excited to see it. I agree with you. Like, I don't want my daughter already calls Google Gable and like thinks that Gable is this omnipotent godlike figure
available
to talk to it in every situation.
And anything and that everything and it's always fact.
Yes. Yeah. And anything that resembles a speaker is Gable, because that's just what she's been taught.
So good.
I want to disabuse her of the of the idea that Gable is everywhere and benevolent, because it is certainly not. All right, let's talk about the new Echo Show 10. Jeremy, this is something that I think you're pretty interested in. It's basically a Nest Hub Max, at least it looks like one, but it has a swiveling motorized screen that will follow you around with its camera. It's got an improved speaker as well, and a 13 megapixel camera that you can cover with a physical shutter. Talk about what Amazon is how Amazon is positioning this, especially since they didn't really talk about any of the lower end Echo shows, right? This was the sole Echo show that was announced yesterday, and it doesn't seem like it's replacing the Echo Show second edition or second gen, nor is it replacing the Echo Show 5 or 8.
Yeah, they still have, I looked right before the show started, they still have the Echo Show second gen, which I believe is coming into its third year already, sale on the site. So I suspect, depending on how this Echo Show 10 is received, we could see refreshes to, you know, the 5 and the 8 sizes, and then the whole line and look of it gets phased over the coming year or so. We'll see. Or it could just be a premium product that sits above them all. By far and away, it was as cute as the spherical echoes were. By far and away, this is what was the most interesting. So the first thing they started talking about when they showed the demo was, you know, a smart speaker is great. You know, a lot of people have these in their kitchen or their offices, but in particular in your kitchen, you're moving around. You're going from side to side of the room. You may be preparing a recipe with some of the cool Food Network tie-ins they have, or YouTube videos or whatever. And can't see what's going on, because in 1 minute you're at the sink, and the next minute you're at the fridge, and the next minute you're at the stovetop or something like that. So one of the ideas was that camera is on a swivel. And like you said, it looks really like a Nest Hub Max. And that's what, third generation iMac or whatever, had a baby.
Yeah.
And it kind of follows you around like that. It can see, like the Nest Hub Max, can recognize you as you walk by it and activate the screen. This thing will actually follow you, which at first blush sounds creepy.
Yes.
But then when you realize it's to give you a better angle view, if you're trying to read a recipe, look at a recipe, or video chat with family and the kids are running around or something like that, I can picture this thing spinning its head around like crazy. That's pretty cool, actually. The fact that it has a 13 megapixel front-facing camera is a huge upgrade from any of those other smart displays. And they touted the ability to do, you know, group chats and group video chats and integration with not only, I forget what they call their own service, Echo or Alexa calling, and Zoom and Skype. And they mentioned one other service that I didn't quite catch. That's all great. And I think that'll just really enhance the experience of using a smart display and make it more usable rather than just kind of essentially a small TV. But where it really got interesting and creepy, potentially creepy, was when they were talking about how you could use it as essentially like a home security camera.
Yeah.
And you can you know, if you're away from home, you can open up your Alexa app and kind of use your finger to scroll and pan through the room to see what's going on. You know, that's no different than some other smart home cameras, so that's fine. But they mentioned specifically something called Sentry Mode, and that immediately had me thinking of like Judge Dredd or Wall-E or something like that, where you would essentially, it's literally its head is on a swivel, and periodically it'll just kind of scan the room and let you know if anything's untoward or out of order. There's value in that, but there's a creepy factor too.
Well, I mean, it's not quite as invasive as what we'll get to with the Ring indoor cam. But no, I what's interesting is that, you know, Amazon obviously owns Ring. This can operate as a security camera, but so can the Nest Hub Max, right? The Nest Hub Max, right. if you enable the camera, operates, it lives in your Nest app, which, you know, I've disabled because I don't want, basically I get nothing from turning the camera on where my Nest Hub Max is located. It's right by my sink, so the only people it sees are my wife and I, like, washing the dishes, which is not interesting to me. But again, like, it also just comes down to the fact that, like, these are stationary products that are usually meant to be in places that are either not as visible or are not positioned the way that a dedicated security camera would be positioned, right? Like, they're high up on a bookshelf somewhere, or they are tucked away in a kitchen. The camera itself is not located in an ideal position, and neither is the speaker itself. What's interesting about this is that it's not clear whether you can physically move the screen if you don't want, like, independent of a video call, can you use a joystick of some sort to, like, physically move the screen and locate, you know, and use that as a security camera?
Yeah, they did mention in one of the demos, they showed a person that had the Alexa app open and they were kind of like panning through their living room, or at least rotating through. I don't know if you can pan up and down necessarily. I don't remember seeing that.
I think it's just rotating, yeah. And then my other question was, can you lock it? Because I think all of the smart speakers, there's typically a switch or a button that'll shut the microphone off or close the camera.
Yeah, you can physically close the camera, but you cannot, I don't know if you could lock the microphone. That might be a software-only thing.
Right, or even the swivel.
Yeah, even on the other Echo shows, the microphone is a button.
It's a physical, it's a button, that's right.
Yeah. And so that actually means that now all of the show devices with cameras now have buttons and switches, which they didn't have before.
It does look like, just based on what I'm, like, a cursory look at the Echo Show listing on Amazon, it does look like the Echo Show second gen is being discontinued. So it's no longer going to be available. It's just the all new Echo Show 10, which it's calling the third gen Echo Show, plus the Echo Show 8, and then the Echo Show 5. So it's understandable, right? Like, as long as the speaker is just as good as the one on the Echo Show second gen, which it should be, this is a massive upgrade for the same price. It's $250. We don't know when it's coming out. Amazon is still saying that it's coming soon, rather than it's not even letting people pre-order it. But I'm excited about this one, especially since Amazon said yesterday as well that it is adding Netflix support to its Echo Show devices,
which
recently came to the Nest Hub and Google and other other Google smart displays, which is, you know, puts it in parity there. So Amazon is clearly filling in the gaps. The only downside to me, honestly, is that Amazon products like this will not support Google Photos, because, you know, Jeremy, you've tried Amazon Photos, you've done a review of it, you've compared it to Google Photos. It just does not come anywhere close to being as good from a software perspective.
That's one thing. Like, I think I'm going to have a Nest Hub Max in my living room or kitchen for a long time, because I love the Google Photos. Is just so much smarter than the Amazon Photos.
Like, yeah.
Down to
Google Photos is amazing.
Like, Google Photos on those smart displays will automatically rotate pictures if they're not in the right orientation, or one of the Echo Shows or even Fire TV, even if something's not cropped correctly, you'll see somebody's belly button instead of the whole picture. And it's just, like, aggravating.
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff Google Photos still does better. Google you know, for what it lacks in hardware nuance, which it's getting better at. I think Amazon still makes a better suite of hardware than Google. The services that Google offers, the OS itself on its smart displays just feels more coherent and cohesive. And then there's Google Photos as an ambient display. It's night and day. I really wish that Amazon would, if it was smart, honestly, if I know Amazon and Google have this sort of like tense relationship that borders on hostile at times, but if Amazon was smart, it would just let you tap into the Google Photos API and just show even a rudimentary integration of Google Photos would make me much more likely to use this in a place like my kitchen, where I love seeing those photos on my Nest Hub Max. And I would honestly prefer to use this, because in every other way, this just seems like a superior product.
Well, and YouTube as well.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't have any interest in watching YouTube videos on my
smart
display.
I can see
people
doing cooking videos and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, not really. Because you can still do that on here, right? Amazon has food network integration.
Well, and they also have their Silk browser and Firefox.
So right, exactly, yeah. If you really want to watch YouTube, you can always cast it from the Amazon app if you want. Or download the Silk or whatever. I don't know. I don't recommend it.
There's a way.
There's a way. if there's a will, there's a way. I'm sure somebody's figured it out. All right, let's talk a little bit about these Ring products, because hoo boy, this is something else. So started out as, you know, Ring being, you know, we knew that Ring products were coming. We maybe were naive in thinking that they would just be refreshes to the cameras that we know and maybe hate or love, depending on your affinity for Ring as a brand and its relationship to the police. So first thing first, Ring Car Alarm, Ring Car Cam, and Ring Car Connect. $60, $200, and $200. The Ring Alarm makes sense. It's basically an ODB2 port integration, similar to a lot of other products there. You can basically use it to ping your phone if your car is broken into. It's got a built-in siren. It'll use the Ring app to send you notifications. Very, very simple. Does not really take a lot of explanation. The car cam, it's sort of like an indoor dash cam, I guess. And it has an outdoor camera and an indoor camera. So you can you use it as a dash cam, but it also has an indoor camera in case your car gets broken into. Again, there's a siren. You can send emergency reports. And you can even say, you know, Alexa, I'm being pulled over during a traffic stop, and it will record your voice and video of the encounter, which, you know, I've read on Twitter a lot of our Black colleagues in the industry were actually quite excited about. They thought that this was something that will be very useful for people who do get unreasonably or pulled over unreasonably often. And, you know, it's not for me. You know, I'm a white person. I have that white privilege that that comes with not being pulled over for the color of my skin, and it's something that I would love to explore later on with somebody who's willing to talk to me about it. So maybe we'll have one of our Black colleagues on in a future podcast and talk very frankly about how they perceive a product like the Ring Car Cam, because on the one hand, Ring and the Ring Neighbors app, people have a very, very opinionated relationship with it, right? It's very controversial. Ring has shared a lot of information with the police departments in various parts of the U.S. Sometimes they haven't always disclosed those relationships or the extent of those relationships. But again, this could be something that could benefit a lot of marginalized people. So I'm excited to learn more about that. And then Ring Car Connect is, it's interesting. It's going to launch first in Tesla cars next year. And it basically will dig into the sensors within the cars. So it's more about like, this is telling you how your car is doing from a health perspective. And because Teslas are basically just computers on wheels, it's probably easier to integrate with a Tesla than like a Ford or something that it may not be quite as advanced computationally. So yeah, curious about that as well. And then Nick, walk us through the in-home devices, because I just don't even know where to go with this one. What is the Ring Always Home Cam, first of all, and why? Why does this exist?
I'm going to be weird and say that this is my personal favorite thing they announced, because I think it's awesome.
Okay, tell us more.
Okay, so this thing is literally a drone that will has a camera and a microphone on it and can fly through your house and tell you if, I don't know, somebody broke into it or if you want to check on your kids or your dog or whatever. I think the difference here between this and just, you know, remotely connecting a drone or something is sort of twofold. So it's designed to only go to predetermined spots in your home. I don't think they really told us how that works, but I assume you would probably fly it around, pick a spot, and then name it. And then later on in the app, you would say, go to the living room, and it'll undock itself and fly to the living room. And then it also connects to Ring Alarm. Again, they didn't really discuss how automated that is, but I think the implication is if your house gets broken into or Ring Alarm thinks it's broken into, let's say it's in your bedroom window, it can tell the Always Home cam to go fly to your bedroom and check out the window. Now, again, that's me inferring, but that's what it seems like. What I liked about this is that, number one, it docks completely into this like square dock and it hides the camera and the microphone, which for me is a huge deal because I will not put cameras inside my house. I absolutely refuse. I won't even pick up the Nest ones where it's a screen with a camera on it. It bothers me. I will have outdoor cameras all day, but the indoor ones freak me out. So this being able to physically go into a dock makes it way more likely that I would actually buy it. And then number two, it only records when it's undocked. And I don't know what assurances they can give us that that's the case. I guess that might be where the really freaky part comes in.
You know what? That's actually interesting. I didn't quite think of that, right? Like, to me, this is such an invasion of privacy, this idea of having a flying camera zooming by you as you may be sitting at your desk, like doing, you know, sentry, basically, as Jeremy said, doing patrol. But the fact that it's only recording when it's flying and then there is no visible camera when it's docked, it means that it's kind of this passive thing that is, you know, you could always disable it explicitly, right? If you don't want it recording ever. But when it is docked, it is basically just this, it's this dead thing. It doesn't work, except that it's listening for reasons to start patrolling again. I don't know. I'm not sure. It's just hard to believe that this is something that exists, you know?
It's pretty futuristic.
It's very strange, and it's not coming out until next year.
It's very much throwing something against the wall to see what sticks.
But this does not feel like Ring is just throwing its hat, I mean, excuse the pun, throwing its hat into the ring and seeing if it can, you know, try to find a... Yeah, this is definitely a company that wants this form factor to be normalized, right? Drones are obviously no longer controversial from a product perspective, but indoor drones don't exist yet. They just, especially patrol surveillance drones, they just don't exist yet. And for Ring, which already has a fractious relationship with privacy advocates, to so brazenly launch an indoor drone, I'm just amazed at the tenacity of a company like this to have this in their product lineup.
I think something else I forgot to say earlier as well. They specifically mentioned that the fans on this thing were loud.
Yeah.
So not only are you going to see this thing, unlike a stationary camera that might be sitting there looking at you in a corner, but you're going to hear it. And there's literally no way for somebody to get in this thing, fly around your house, and you not know. And I think that's what gives me more peace of mind versus, you know, let's say you got your Nest cam sitting there in the corner, and while Google accounts are super ultra secure, they're not impossible to break into, you know, and that's for me probably the height of security as far as these kinds of devices go. Everything, I don't want to say under that, but, you know, several other companies don't have the security Google has. And having those types of things in my house are kind of a big no-no versus this.
Right. And it's also worth noting that Ring announced that starting soon, its video will be end-to-end encrypted between your phone and its servers, right? So if for whatever reason this does capture something untoward that you don't want uploaded to the cloud, you will have more confidence that nobody's going to intercept it, right? And that you will should be able to delete it quickly. And you know what? I agree with you to some extent. The fact that this is it's an opt-in rather than an ambient, video capture, right? You are opting into allowing this to capture only when it's in flight. It's loud. You're certainly not going to mistake this for anything else.
Right. But,
you know, in a world where you have people over for dinner, again, I don't know when that's going to be possible. And all of a sudden your Amazon drone hears something upstairs and starts flying above you to get upstairs. Like, that is legitimately creepy. And it's not so much that I think it's an invasion of privacy so much as just a cultural norm that I don't know how long it's going to take for us to be comfortable with.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know that I like the automated portion. I think that would be something I would probably turn off. Because, yeah, like you said, having it just all of a sudden pick up and go, oh, I think I hear something over here. Then that brings in, okay, is this a person controlling this thing? Or is this the automated AI or whatever is supposed to be controlling this? And that's, I don't like the questions like that.
Right. Yeah. At the same time, it also feels a bit like there's sort of like a pet-like quality to it, you know? Like your dog's ears perk up or your cat runs to hear a sound or check out a new smell. Like, there's definitely that aspect of it too, that the physical movement of a drone indicates that there is something to be scared of or suspect.
Right.
And that just doesn't happen with these ambient cameras, right? Something has to come into its line of sight for it to react.
Oh, Daniel, now you've got me panicking that the next version is going to be like a Ring nanny cam there that moves around the house or something.
Right. I mean, think about, this is a first-gen product that already has, it's so opinionated about what it can do. Imagine in 2 or 3 years when we have a second or third generation. But at the same time, like, Jeremy, you've written about the history of the Amazon Echo line, right? This was not a thing until 6 years ago. We did not have ambient microphones in our home until just 6 years ago.
Right.
And now it is completely normal to have not just one, but many of them throughout our home. And we don't care. Well, you care, Nick, but
it's only been a couple of years that, yeah, we care.
Well, not the mics, just the cameras.
It's only been
ironically
a couple of years that people have started to realize and care that the mics are always on. You know, when did that first break
right
about the contractors listening to it? That was like 2 years ago. So
yeah, that was 2 or 3 years ago. And that was Ring. That was not Google.
Yeah.
That was not some other company. That was Ring's third party contractors.
Right.
Listening in on people's private conversations, looking at their video. And that happened because Ring was not explicit about how its customers' data was used. They were using these audio snippets to train their machine learning models, which Google does as well and Apple as well. They all three of these companies have been called out for it. But
yep,
Ring went an extra step of having its third-party contractors use this for their own personal edification. And that is very disturbing. But it's also a reputation that the company has really, really tried to fight back against. And then it goes and releases an indoor drone with a camera. So I don't know. It's interesting. At the same time, Ring is still its own company, right? It's part of Amazon's announcements, but it is a company that builds its own products, probably with a lot of input from Amazon's hardware division. Jeremy, you're currently reviewing the Halo health band right now, which you're holding up to the camera. And this is an Amazon product that asks you to take photos of your half naked body so that it can assess your body fat percentage.
It listens to your voice all day long and tells you if you're being snarky to your wife or your boss or your coworker or something like that. So, you know, they're getting very close to the point where, you know, cradle to the grave with an Echo Dot Kids edition and a Ring drone and an Amazon Halo band that analyzes your body fat percentage and your voice tone
and a camera that follows your face throughout your house.
Exactly. Everything store is going to know everything about you. So,
I mean, more than it does already, which is hard
to
believe that's even possible. So
exactly.
I don't know. This is fascinating to me. Ring is so unapologetically bold with its choices that in some ways I just have to give them respect for that. There's just no other company like it. All right, let's move on quickly talking about the Eero 6. These are two new routers, Eero 6, Eero Pro 6. They're Eeros with Wi-Fi 6. There's not a whole lot more you need to know about other than the fact that I have had no better or more consistent performing or at least stably performing router in my home than the Eero. And the only reason I gave it up this year for a Linksys Wi-Fi 6 mesh solution was because it's Wi-Fi 6. These will be my next routers, period. I loved using Eero. They just worked. They worked so well. But I have a gigabit connection. The old Eero Pro just did not go past like 550 or 580 megabits. So these will be my next routers, period. They are so good. I don't know about you guys. Any opinions on these?
Did the previous ones have Zigbee built into it, like a Zigbee hub?
No, they had Thread built into it.
Okay, so that's something new with this too, which at least for me personally is nice because, you know, that could replace maybe your Wink hub that you wanted to get rid of or something like that, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm excited about this because the Eero Pro is, you know, it's still tri-band, so it has that 5.8 gigahertz backhaul that I really like. It doesn't carry everything over the main 5 gigahertz band. It has a Zigbee smart hub in it. It updates automatically. It's simple to set up. It just works, and it's very unobtrusive. Whereas the one that I have right now, it's the Linksys MX5. It's this massive, sort of monolithic. Like it just looks like a router. No, it's not as bad as some of those like Asus gaming routers, but it definitely looks like a router. Wherever you put it, it's very hard to hide this thing. Whereas Eero is unobtrusive. It just fits into any decor you have around your house. So I'm excited about this one.
Yeah, I've had nothing but good experiences with mine. I've got fiber internet as well, and I regularly get 900 plus down from my Eero. So if this is better than that, great.
That's a lot. Yeah, I didn't even know it was possible to get that high. Okay, Luna. Nick, walk us through Luna, because this is wild, and it kind of came out of nowhere for me. I know we had seen a leak of an Amazon branded game controller a couple of days before the announcement, but nobody got any wind of this game streaming platform, which was a huge, huge win for Amazon. It was really a big surprise.
Yeah, I don't really know how they kept this one under wraps, but it's Amazon's competition to Stadia, I think, primarily just in, I guess we'll say, form factor or services alone, because it is a cloud-based service entirely. You would use a controller and some sort of screen to play your games on. Amazon is going to sell that controller for $50, and just like Stadia's controller, the controller itself connects directly to Wi-Fi. It makes gaming better because it's lower latency. You can also use any controller you have. I don't think they necessarily said if there are restrictions on that, but basically if you're using a phone, you get a Bluetooth controller, you can pull up Luna. It's $6 a month, and it includes, as of launch, 100 games. So unlike Stadia, where you have to buy the games in addition to paying for the service if you want the higher quality or whatever, Luna is effectively Microsoft's Game Pass mixed with Stadia, but probably way better than what Google did so far. They're also partnering with Ubisoft to bring like Assassin's Creed and a bunch of the other new Ubisoft stuff. They didn't say the pricing yet. They just said coming soon. But I think it's also key. You know, these are unlimited hours of play. Right now it's 1080p, 60 frames a second. They got 4K coming soon. And then you can stream these on basically any device. And I also thought it was really cool because the regular $6 a month Luna subscription lets you stream to two devices at a time. So for $6, you can have two phones and two controllers and play against each other on any of the 100 games that support multiplayer.
Yeah, and there are some good games here, right? There's Resident Evil 7, there's Control, there's a few other tier one games in the Luna Plus channel.
Right.
And And then the Ubisoft side is, you know, every tier one, your AAA unit, you know, Assassin's Creed Valhalla and a bunch of others.
Far Cry 6 stuff coming up.
Yeah, exactly. Those are going to be good. But what I think people have missed in this conversation are a couple of things. First, this is the $6 a month price is early access, which means that it will expire and that it'll probably go up to $9.99 a month, where Stadia is for its Stadia Pro tier. The second part is that Ubisoft and other channels will have separate pricing. So the $6 a month does not give you access to Ubisoft's channel, which at the beginning of the announcement, people weren't really sure, right? Are you paying for one channel? Or is it like a cable subscription where each one will have a separate number? And I believe the way that it's going to work is that Amazon will sell you access to these channels a la carte, and maybe you'll be able to bundle them all together for a discount. So there may be, you know, I was going to say a Bethesda channel, but that's not going to happen with Microsoft's acquisition.
Well, you never know.
there may be, I don't know, some other Blizzard may have, or Activision may have its own channel, and you may have access to some of those games for an extra $5 or $6 a month. The good thing for publishers here is that even like EA integrated with Xbox Game Pass Ultimate. However, there's nothing that says EA cannot also partner separately with Amazon here and sell access to, you know, EA's you know, channel for the same price as it sells its service separately.
Right.
You know, Origin is a really, I think, a good example of sort of a publisher that has made a really robust service, and by integrating with Xbox, it gives value to somebody who's already buying Game Pass. But this also allows companies that don't want to launch their own streaming service to sort of piggyback on Amazon's infrastructure here. So the other thing that's interesting to know is that because it's AWS, it's already sort of using Windows and NVIDIA hardware. So it's using Windows on the software side and NVIDIA rack, you know, PCs on the hardware side, which is going to make it significantly easier for publishers to port their games over than Stadia, which uses a Linux-based backend and a sort of a custom, even though the hardware is really powerful, it uses a custom rack machine there. So I don't know. I mean, it's fascinating to me. The other part, Nick, that is curious is that Amazon is bypassing the iOS App Store entirely by launching the iPhone and iPad apps as a progressive web app. You'll be able to play Luna through your Safari browser on your iPhone or iPad, which to me just blows my mind. What do you think about this?
That was really smart, because now they're not going to end up like Epic.
Right.
Yep. Or I guess Microsoft, really, because Microsoft can't even get Game Pass on iOS for the exact same reason. Apple wants to charge them 30% for every single title in Game Pass, and that's not going to happen.
Not to mention the fact that all of these games will have to have their own App Store listing, which these developers or these publishers do not want, because they don't want to have their AAA console title perceived as just another iOS game.
Exactly. This model simply doesn't work for that model. They're just not compatible. I think what you were saying before, this is sort of prime video-ifying video games. Terrible term, but you know, you subscribe to Prime Video, you go on there, you've got stuff that's included with Prime, stuff that's not included with Prime, and then the channels. So, you know, like I know for my wife and I, anytime there's a show on, we'll just say Stars, we'll subscribe to Stars for a month, we'll binge whatever show it is, and then we'll not subscribe anymore. And I have a feeling that it could very well happen with this type of service where, you know, the new Assassin's Creed comes out, you drop $10 or whatever on an Ubisoft pass, you play the thing for a month, and then you cancel it, and you're never stuck buying hardware. You're never stuck with having to resell the game. It's kind of a win-win for everybody. And I really, really like this concept. I just wonder how good the quality is going to be for most people.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's 1080p to launch, and then 4K will come later on for select titles. And that looks like it's only part of the Luna Plus channel. So Ubisoft is not committing to 4K for now. We know based on the controversial opening few months of Stadia, when Google claimed that some games were playing in 4K, they weren't actually. They were sort of at like 1440p upscaled. Some of them were not hitting the frame rates that Google was promising. So just getting to 1080p 60 is a good launch goal here. I don't think anybody's going to complain about that. And, you know, it'll sort of calm everybody down to know that 4K is coming later on. Oh, right. Sorry, I'm wrong. Ubisoft is offering 4K later on, but not at launch either.
Yeah, so it just says coming soon.
There's no Android app at launch either. Amazon isn't really saying why, other than they're still building it. I don't know if it's an issue with Google or the Play Store, or whether there is some other, you know, other solution or other issue to solve, but it's coming eventually. If you want to play it in the short term, you can play it on PC, Mac, the web apps on iOS or iPad, and Fire TV obviously will be the best place for it, lower latency.
And I'm sure they'll have a combo pack with Fire TV and the controller or something when it launches.
Yeah. 100%. And Luna's only launching in the US at first, and it's only mainland US. So, you know, people in Hawaii or like Puerto Rico won't be able to play it for obvious reasons, because lag here is the most important part. And
right.
And Amazon wants to have CDNs all over the domestic US. Okay, now we're not going to talk about the Fire Sticks, because they're Fire Sticks. They're a known quantity. So we'll talk quickly about these Google leaks. Let's stay on the topic of smart home. Google's Chromecast with Google TV, which is the rumored name for this thing, the Sabrina dongle, as it leaks a few months ago. It will have an Android TV build out of the box. We're not really sure what it means by Google TV yet, other than if it may just have a slightly different interface to what we know of as Android TV today. But somebody sold a person this retail unit, which is always what happens with Google products before they're launched. So we now have a look through the Chromecast UI. We know that it's basically an Android TV box mixed with a Chromecast, and that it has sort of this like live TV integration, which Google has been teasing for a long time. And yeah, there's not a whole lot to say about it. Jeremy, what's your first impression of this product?
Yeah, I mean, it's really more of a direct competitor to a Fire TV Stick or a Roku Premiere or something than a Chromecast ever was. In large part because you are getting that interface, and it comes with a remote too, I believe, right?
Yeah, a really good remote if the leaks are correct.
Yeah, it looks nice.
I think this could do really well depending on how they price it, because those, you know, the $30, $40 Fire Sticks and Rokus just fly off the shelves. They're almost impulse buys. And if you can get something like this that has great connections to Google services and Google Photos, like we were talking about earlier, I think a lot of people are going to go for it.
Right. Yeah, we're not sure what the price is yet. It's rumored to be about $50, which would put it, you know, in line with other 4K sticks. As you mentioned, the Fire TV 4K is $50. And it would also, if I'm not mistaken, be cheaper than the Chromecast Ultra.
I was just going to say that. That's cheaper because the Chromecast Ultra is $70.
Right. So if this has 4K support, it would replace, I would assume, the Chromecast Ultra, leaving just this and the redesigned $30, $35 Chromecast that Google launched a couple of years ago. So I think that would be an interesting value proposition, right? If you don't need the UI, the actual controller or the TV interface, you just buy the $35 Chromecast, which is like down to $19 every year around this time, or you spend the extra little bit and you get the $50 Chromecast with Google TV. So I'm excited about this. I'm skeptical, as always, of all Android TV products because they always end up disappointing me in some way. But I'm holding out hope that this will be a good one. Let's talk a little bit about the Nest Audio. Nick, this is another product that Google teased earlier this year. It just sent everybody a render of this thing when there was a leak.
Yeah, I remember.
It was very weird. They just emailed me a teaser photo of it. Now that we have an unboxing of it, we know a bit more about it. It looks very heavy. It looks very, very much like a smaller Google Home Max.
Yes.
And
yeah, that's exactly what it reminded me of.
Yeah. And you know, other than that, like, I don't really know what else to say. There's a Redditor who has a throwaway account who posted about, you know, its features. It said that the sound quality is blows away the original Google Home, which is encouraging. And it's got its own subwoofer and tweeter in there, much like the new Amazon Echo. I don't know. What's your take on it? It seems like a pretty straightforward value prop.
I actually, when this was first announced, I told my wife, I was like, I want to get two of these, put them in stereo mode now that that's a thing, and put them in our kitchen, because the only thing we have in our kitchen right now is the original Nest Hub with no camera. Mm-hmm. And we use that thing to listen to music, and it sucks for music. It's terrible.
Oh, yeah.
I just don't have another speaker to stick in there, so we deal with it. But I would love to upgrade to something like this that, I mean, at least based on the size, probably has some real, you know, bass and some decent range of sound, and probably doesn't sound like a tinny cheap speaker. But I will miss the screen if I do that.
I don't know. I'm curious about this because Google has not made a significant upgrade to its audio stack in, you know, since the Nest Hub to the Google Home Max, right? The smart displays have decent speakers, right? The Nest Hub Max has a decent speaker, but it is not the main selling point for that.
Right.
Right. It's still a screen with a speaker rather than a dedicated speaker.
Yes.
And obviously the Nest Mini has a much improved speaker than the original Google Home Mini, but again, doesn't even come close to the original Google Home.
It's still not fantastic.
No.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm curious about this. At $100, which is the rumored price point, this could sell very well. And who knows? It may be a huge hit, but it's a very simple product that I don't think has a lot more to say about it. If there's some like fancy Google Assistant integration, then we'll talk about it. But they'll be announced, both of them, on September 30th. So we don't have much more time to wait on that. Then the Google Pixel 5 and 4a 5G have leaked all to hell in the last few days. We've seen a green Pixel 5, which I love. We've seen
it's gorgeous.
The Pixel 4a 5G. We know basically everything about it, including what it looks like on both sides. Not really sure what I, again, like these have both leaked like crazy over the last few months. Jeremy, what's your take on both of these phones? I mean, you have a Pixel 4a right now.
Yeah, I love it. It's one of my favorite phones ever, actually, which kind of surprises me. I'm looking forward to the Pixel 5 in particular. I would love to get that green one, and I'm so glad that they're doing away with OSO Orange. I think I might have been the only person in the tech community that felt as strongly about it as I did, but this one looks good.
Say this is my favorite like phone color ever. So yeah, well,
the orange one,
that orange Pixel 4.
Yeah, I feel like Jeremy's gonna have to fight you through the computer here.
I have opinions, but that's fine. Never mind.
It's okay. I own it. I don't care.
but yeah, I don't think that I would upgrade to the 5 personally now, especially since I just got the 4A a month ago or whatever. And particularly for me, what I like about the 4A, I don't miss 5G. I can't really get it right now. And I love the size of it. I love that it's a smaller phone and how lightweight it is. Yes, I would like NFC for sure. Well, I guess it does have NFC. I would like wireless charging and waterproofing. And I'm sure the 5 is going to have both of those things. But just the overall form factor of the 4A is kind of the sweet spot for me.
Yeah, I agree. I'm excited about not about 5G, just about the better battery life. And the, you know, for me, the wireless charging and waterproofing of the Pixel 5, that's going to make all the difference to me. I really do rely on wireless charging, and I have a 2-year-old who's constantly taking my phone, so my Pixel 4a has been in some very precarious positions over the last few weeks and has almost dropped in the bath a bunch of times, which is my fault because I shouldn't have my phone near my daughter when she's in the bath. But it is, you know, it's just she's a kid and just takes everything, and anyway, it is.
Does she ask for Hey Gable?
She does ask for that. She asked me to play songs in the bath, which I do. I put the phone next to me while I play the song, and then she splashes all over the place, and it's just, it's terrifying, but you know, it is, it's just a phone, whatever. Her happiness at listening to, you know, Elmo while we're in the bath is worth me losing a phone for.
See, I would have thought Baby Shark was the go-to bath time song.
It was in the March and April period. Now it's, we've moved on. We went to Raffi and then Sharon Lewis and Bram and then Elmo. And now we're on Peppa Pig, because apparently not only is Peppa Pig the worst TV show in the world, but it is also the worst album that you can find on Spotify, which I can't even with this freaking Peppa Pig. Yeah, don't even get me started. This is a total tangent, but we listened to Peppa Pig on the way to and from daycare, and I've had these terrible songs in my head all day today. They're just such earworms, right? Like, they're nothing songs, but they just burrow their way into your skull, and I can't even even if I listen to something else, it doesn't go away. It's just awful. Save me, internet, please. All right, we're going to take a break, and we will come back and talk about the Oculus Quest 2 and what's making us happy. We'll be right back. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by SanDisk. We've all experienced the problem of running out of storage space on our phones, and that's why we've been talking about SanDisk over the last few weeks, the global leader in data storage solutions that has you covered no matter what smartphone you have. A few months ago, I made the mistake of buying a phone with the minimum amount of storage, 64 gigabytes, that you should buy with a phone today, and I ran out of storage pretty darn quickly. But that's why I use SanDisk's Ultra Dual Drive Lux USB Type-C flash drive with capacities from 32 gigs all the way up to 1 terabyte for my storage. The Dual Drive Lux has 150 megabyte per second read speeds that let you transfer photos and videos faster. Plus, SanDisk makes other great products for both Android and Apple devices, like the Extreme Micro SD UHS 1 card and the iXpand Flash Drive Go. Take our advice, free up space on your phone with SanDisk. Right now, get 10% off your first order of these SanDisk products, but only when you go to sandisk.com/ACP. That's sandisk.com/ACP. Don't wait. Go to sandisk.com/ACP. And thanks, SanDisk, for sponsoring the Android Central podcast. All right, we're going to do this quickly because that first segment went way, way, way over. But Nick, give us the, I don't know, 5-minute elevator pitch on this Oculus Quest 2, what it is, why it's controversial, why Ars Technica gave it like a terrible review and said, don't buy it. And then Polygon gave it a super positive review and said, it's the best cord-free VR headset you can buy today. What is going on here? Give us the scoop.
All right. So quick rundown on the Quest 2. It's probably one of the most substantial hardware updates I think we've seen going from one generation to the next. So the processor is like 3.5 generations newer than the original. It's got more RAM. The display is 50% more pixel dense. Plus, it uses an RGB stripe display, so it looks even more pixel dense than it actually is. The thing is a little bit lighter, and they changed the... I don't know where to even start with these reviews. For the most part, I've seen super positive reviews. I think the Ars Technica one definitely stands out among them, and I kind of feel like the comfort factor of this one is going to play a huge role in whether or not you like it. So the original Oculus Quest, Jeremy, you have one, right? And I thought you said you had one. Sorry. Anyhow, so the original Oculus Quest, the head strap is slightly uncomfortable, right? It's very forward heavy. It leans on your cheeks a lot. It doesn't really cradle your head the way a VR headset should. It's not terrible, but it's certainly not the best. The new one is a cloth strap, which is much more like the less expensive Oculus Go, which should give a wider variety of heads more comfort. But the real strap that I guess you would want to get if you pick up a Quest 2 is the Elite strap, which is $50. And that thing is effectively one of the best straps you'll buy for any VR headset. The next thing that is not fixable is the IPD adjustment, which is the difference between, or I'm sorry, the distance between your pupils. So every human's different, has a different shape. And part of that shape is that your eyes are a different distance from one another. In kind of a controversial way, Facebook eliminated people. Let me reword that.
They eliminated people. That is accurate.
Eliminated people. Wait, that might be accurate. So let me back that up. That's right. They eliminated the possibility for people with a wider IPD to even use the Quest 2. So this thing, the average distance is about 63 millimeters. This thing covers between 58 and 68. On the original Quest, you had a simple slider that would adjust the lenses 1 millimeter every time you slide the thing, right? And you had from 58 to, I think it was 70 or 71 it capped out at. So already you're taking out probably a notable percentage of people. And if you don't play with the right lens distance, you're going to get sick. There's really just no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You're going to get a headache. It might make you sick. It's not going to be a fun experience. So them having changed this the way they did is semi-questionable. And I think that's part of where we're seeing the dichotomy in these reviews is people who probably have a wider IPD are finding this more uncomfortable. And that's not the case with everybody, but I think that's going to be something that comes up more often as it gets released in 2 or 3 weeks here, whatever October 13th is. I guess that's 3 weeks. And then, of course, there's the battery life issue. So since this is a way more powerful processor, generally those are more energy efficient. But for whatever reason, it turns out that this has about a half an hour less playtime than the original Quest. Facebook sort of offset that by selling an Elite strap that has a battery in it. I don't know what the difference in that playtime goes. But again, you're going to have to buy something additional to make it more comfortable. I guess the caveat there is this thing's $100 less for each SKU than the original Quest. And the more expensive SKU features twice the amount of storage. So 256 gigs of storage versus 128 on the original Quest.
Okay, so high level here, there's Oculus has gone through, it's sort of run the gamut of what kind of VR headsets it offers, right? It started with the Rift. It then, you know, it went really low end with the Go. Came back with the Rift S. I may get my timeline wrong here. The Quest came shortly after the Go, and then now we have the Oculus Quest 2. The Quest 2 feels like this is the segment that Facebook/Oculus wants to focus. Right, it's not PC tethered VR, which is a niche category. It's more expensive, but it has the potential to be much more powerful. It is certainly not the very very low end $200 Oculus Go, which sold okay, but not nearly as well as the Quest. The Quest seemed to be the sweet spot. So
yeah,
lowering the cost by $100, which brings it into the middle of what the Go and the original Quest cost. Where do you see this playing out, you know, with the actual ecosystem? Because controversially, Facebook now requires you to have a Facebook account when you have a Quest headset. But it does seem like of all of the, you know, from the Steam or the Valve Index to the HTC Vive, this seems to be attracting the most developer interest and therefore the better games. And it does seem like the Quest is the future of mainstream VR. So tell me where Facebook is going with this as a platform now that the hardware is sort of in a mature space.
Okay, yeah. So I wrote an editorial on basically this exact thing about this time last year, not realizing that we were going to get this huge of an upgrade this year. And I think there were a lot of people in that same category, at least in the industry. And this kind of shows to me, especially with the pricing, which at $299 is the same price as an Xbox Series S. And then Facebook also made some announcements that they're partnering with Ubisoft to bring an Assassin's Creed and a Splinter Cell to the Oculus platform. I'm assuming it's just the Quest, but they didn't necessarily specify with those. They have several other big names. They have like Jurassic World. They had doing a Myst remake. You know, they're kind of going all in on the gaming front. They've now bought a few developers to make as first party studios. I think based on the sales of the Quest in the last year and a half, it's sort of proven that, like you're saying, you know, PC VR is still going to be around. But for the most part, it's a niche category. And with this, they announced that they are sunsetting the Rift S. They're sunsetting the original Quest. This thing is their now singular model to do everything primarily on its own. And being positioned more of a, as a console, I think, is an important role for them to continue to grow VR as an industry, particularly in the game segment. Because we've seen a lot of other, I guess, implications and implementations of VR aside from gaming since it sort of became mainstream in 2016, or at least pseudo mainstream.
Yeah. And we had you on back in May to talk about Half-Life Alyx and the success of the Oculus and how difficult it was to buy a Quest at the time. You talked about Beat Saber and how Oculus bought Beat Games to integrate it into, like, as a first party publisher. Facebook is clearly, they've taken steps to ensure that they are shepherding the platform in the right way. And then a few weeks ago, they go and force people to sign up for Facebook if they want to continue using Oculus. Walk us through that decision and why that may get them into regulatory trouble. And what happens if people just decide they don't want to sacrifice their privacy in the name of playing VR games?
Right. So that particular announcement was a huge blow to the community because I can't remember the exact time, but we'll just say 4 years ago, they said basically, or maybe even was 2014 when they bought Oculus, that they promised to never do this. And they literally went right back on what they said. And here we are. If you buy a Quest 2, you got to use a Facebook account. And if you've never used an Oculus device before, you can't even sign up for a new Oculus account as of October 1st. So you got, what, 6-7 days, whatever the end of September is, to do that if that really bothers you. Even then, current Oculus account holders will probably have to convert to that by 2023. They say you don't have to, but they've already gone back on their word once, so who's to say they won't again? As far as regulatory stuff goes, we know Facebook, Google, et al. Have gotten into plenty of issues, especially in Europe. And we've already seen in Germany, let's see, when was this article? This was,
September 3rd.
The beginning of this month. Jeez, yeah. I actually thought it was more than longer ago than that. But beginning of this month, Oculus had to stop, well, I shouldn't say had, they stopped selling both the Quest and the Rift in Germany due to what they called a regulatory battle. Or discussions with supervisory authorities. In general, it doesn't look great for them in Europe, especially with them now forcing Facebook accounts on users. I understand why they're doing it, because at $300 for the hardware they're putting in the Quest 2, you're going to have to subsidize that stuff. Like, there's really just no way around it. I'd be very surprised if they made any money, much less break even on that hardware. I fully expect them to integrate ads and who knows what else into that because of them likely having to subsidize it. And that's why they're pushing the account system, because they've already got this entire platform that basically half the world uses. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how many, I guess we'll say, regular Joes really care about the fact that they have to log in with a Facebook account. Because, you know, the argument I've used myself and I've seen plenty of other people say is you got to use a Microsoft account with an Xbox. You got to use a Sony account with a PlayStation. Like, this isn't a weird thing. This is the company that makes the product. You got to use their accounts. I think the issue comes in. What?
I said it just happens to be Facebook.
That's the problem. The problem is that Facebook is, I suppose, like we were talking about with Ring earlier, sort of a known entity, and people don't trust them to at least a certain degree.
Well, it's. I also think that it comes down to Facebook is, you know, it's sort of the Dairy Queen problem when I think about it, right? Like, when you think of DQ, you think of them as an ice cream place, right? And every time they try to rebrand and try to, you know, take the dairy out of the name, they try to sell you hot dogs and other things. You know, people are like, what the hell are you doing? Just sell me ice cream. You're good at it, right? Facebook is really good at selling ads. They're really good at making addictive social platforms. They have not been good at making phones. They have not been good. In general, they weren't great at mobile until very recently. They have never really had hardware success. And even the Facebook portal, which has over the pandemic become a little bit more popular because it's actually a pretty good product, people don't want it because it has that Facebook name on it. I think when they bought Oculus, there was this understanding that the firewall was necessary to keep Zuckerberg out of it, right? But at the time when they bought Oculus, the original founders of Instagram and WhatsApp were still at those respective companies. And since then, they have all left. And it is now Facebook executives running those companies, just like it is Facebook running Oculus.
Yeah, I was just going to say, all the original Oculus people are gone too.
Right. And I think that is just exactly what people think, is that Facebook does not have a sterling reputation for consistency, right? They always end up, even if they improve the product, and one could argue that Instagram has been largely ruined by feature creep, but you know, Instagram and WhatsApp, they are still the same fundamental products as they've always been. And there's a side, there's a group of people who are skeptical that, you know, this forcing people to have a Facebook account will ruin Oculus, in the sense that what difference does it make? All it does is really just add a login with Facebook button, and you may have to put up with a few ads, or if you use Instagram, you may see some, you know, future Oculus ad in Instagram while you're scrolling through or whatever. You may get ads for games or something. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but there are two sides of this equation. And if Facebook is willing to subsidize the hardware so that it can eventually show you ads with a cheaper piece of hardware, isn't that worth the trade-off?
It certainly seems like it to me. And I mean, aside from the Facebook login, and at least on the PC, aside from the pseudo walled garden approach, I feel like Facebook has done almost nothing but good for VR. Because at this point, what competition is there to the Quest? I mean, it's not the only standalone headset out there, but I mean, to be frank, it's the only good one out there. All of the other ones are either very purpose-built, they're built for, you know, a VR arcade, or they're built for an industrial type of thing. This is the only, and I like to use the word console because I feel like that's what it is. This is the only VR console that we really see with any sort of developer backing, with any sort of real store that you can go to like any other console and buy a game on, and it doesn't feel weird. You don't have to like sideload stuff to get things working, whatever, right?
Also, hasn't Oculus taken steps to limit what you can sideload? Or am I thinking of something else?
I mean, sort of. So they now require you to register a phone number with your developer account, or you know, a card of some kind, you know, like you're going to buy something or charge people or whatever. It's not really a restriction, but it is one additional step that did not used to be there until the last couple of weeks.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. All right, well, you know, I'm excited to see it. It's coming out in mid-October. I want to have you back to talk about the experience, because for, you know, VR is a fairly new thing for a lot of people, but given the fact that everybody's probably going to be home again this winter, I think a lot of people who are looking for a reasonably priced Black Friday or holiday gift will definitely pick one of these up. And I think the $299 price is no accident, right? That is a
absolutely.
It's not an impulse purchase, but it's certainly closer to an impulse purchase than a $399 Quest. So,
yep.
Definitely curious about that. All right. Well, we are going to end it there. We're going to talk. We're just going to end the show with what's making us happy, because that's always a really nice way to go into, I was going to say the weekend, but you're going to hear this probably by the end of your weekend. But we will start with Jeremy, who we haven't had on the show before. And I'm always really curious, what is making you happy? Because you're just such a happy person in general.
Well, I got two things, actually. I've got a TV show and a podcast. So for TV shows, I've been watching Away on Netflix. It's not the best show ever, but I think it's pretty engaging. And I'm a sucker for a good space exploration show. I like sci-fi, but I like things that could be real. So, you know, The Martian or Contact or that kind of thing. So I'm about halfway through it, and it's been pretty entertaining so far. So that's making me happy on the TV side. And then for the podcast, I mean, obviously the AC podcast, but the one that really makes me laugh is Fake Doctors, Real Friends. And so that's a watch along or a rewatch podcast from Zach Braff and Donald Faison, who were on Scrubs, which is a comedy about medical professionals.
Yes, it was a great show.
And I'm a huge Scrubs nerd, and I can quote pretty much every episode. So they release that about twice a week. It's on iHeart, but you can find it on any podcast client. And it's a lot of fun. And little side note is that I've actually found a way to work Scrubs into several articles of mine. I don't know if
I have noticed that.
So I have some search.
That's the way to do it.
Yeah.
It's funny. You've talked about this podcast before. I don't like watch along podcasts, like the Rewatchables by Ringer. I don't know why. I don't want that commentary, but I love the fact that Donald Faison and Zach Braff are actual friends in real life.
Yeah.
It just makes me happy that this exists. Even though I'll definitely never listen to it. The other thing is I listed Ted Lasso as my thing that made me happy last week. And Bill Lawrence, who made Scrubs, is a executive producer and co-creator of Ted Lasso. And the tone of the show is so similar to Scrubs in many ways that it's very identifiable as a Bill Lawrence like joint. You know what I'm saying? Like it is very, very much in line with the Scrubs. So yeah, that's great.
Apparently Zach Braff directed one of the episodes of Ted Lasso too. So
really? Oh
yeah.
Yeah. I guess that makes sense. All right, Nick, what is making you happy?
This is gaming season, and I feel like it doesn't matter what year it is. If I get through the summer and I'm like bored with gaming, the fall always just destroys me, because there's all of a sudden 67,000 games I absolutely must have, and I don't have time or money to play more than maybe one of them. So,
all right, give me your top three. Which are the ones that you're most looking forward to?
Well, gosh, you had to ask for a checklist. Well, I want a PS5, but I can't get the stinking pre-order. So I really want to play Miles Morales.
Yeah.
I suppose I could play that on the PS4, but, you know,
like an animal.
Lame. That's lame when there's new hardware out. Yeah, like an animal. Exactly. Gosh, let's see. I'm looking forward to... You had to ask me this question. Jeez.
We'll be here another half an hour.
Yes, exactly. Whatever. All right. I just reviewed Gnomes and Goblins, which was a VR game from 4 years ago. We got a preview of it. We finally got the game this week. So that was exciting to go through. And then another one, Until You Fall, just is coming out on Quest next week. And that I had a great time with that in early access last August or September or whatever it was. And it's nice to finally get version one of that and get back to Arm Day. Because Pistol Whip is leg day, I guess, and Until You Fall is Arm Day, or Beat Saber, I guess, whatever one you want to play.
Oh, I see. Okay, I get what you're saying. It's like it's a fighting game that you use your arms.
Yes.
Okay. Fair enough. I'm looking at it right now. It does look very exerting. So
it's ridiculously fun, and the combat. I don't know. The combat feels legit because the physics make the weapons feel heavy. They make hitting something actually feel real. It's kind of weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always wondered about that. I don't want to get into it, but like the haptics in a the haptics in a VR headset, I feel like that's so important. Yeah, anyway. All right, well, that's great. I'm excited to read all of your reviews. Well, I'm very simple this week. What's making me happy is dog parks. I am just, it clears my head. I have a Great Dane that I walk several times a day. I take her to the dog park every day. It's just the most cathartic and relaxing place to be. And honestly, if you could find anything right now that takes your mind out of the shit that is our world, and the fact that there's a pending second wave that's probably going to force us indoors again for a few more months, the nice weather and the fact that I can just get out and hang out at a dog park, which was, they were closed for 2 months in here in Toronto in this between March and May. So that was really tough. And I know it was tough. It was probably harder on me than my dog, but I just love going there. And honestly, it's just, it's a community. It's not just a place where you take your dog. Like, some of my good friends are people I've met there. So yeah, anyway, I'm very happy about the fact that I have lots of dog parks near me and that dogs are the best. So go pet a dog. Yeah. It'll make you feel better. All right. Well, that's our show for this week. Thank you so much, Nick. Thank you so much, Jeremy. It's been so much fun having you. I'm going to tell people where they can find you. Jeremy is at Jeremy. Let me get this right. UTGW, Jeremy with an A, UTGW on Twitter. And Nick is Guanatu on Twitter. I am at Journey Dan. We are all at Android Central. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great week, and we will see you soon. Bye-bye.
Adios.
Later. Bye.